respond to the boss, fire off a nasty email to accounting. Oh boy, we've got a customer service issue. Well, you know how it is. If you want it done right, you've got to do it yourself. Check on an order, read a newsletter, read a personnel announcement from HR. Oh, that looks like an interesting link. And 3 hours later, our well-intentioned sales rep is mired down and getting nowhere. When you open email first thing in the morning, there is almost never good news. That big client you've been trying to close didn't suddenly come to her senses at 2 a.m. and send over a note telling you that you have the deal. Nope, you got 4 messages from your boss giving you non-sales busy work to do, an email from HR informing you that you have not completed the compliance training on the company intranet, a handful of clients asking questions about when they will get their orders, one livid customer who wants you to stop your world and call them because they called customer service at 4 a.m. and no one was there, and 72 cover your ass, FYI, by the way, and oh my God emails that require no action. But you feel compelled to respond immediately to all of them, just so people will know that you're still breathing. Blocking out the first 1 to 2 hours of each day for a focused telephone block is the mark of fanatical prospectors. This is why Anthony Iorino is so passionate about moving email to a later time in your day. He explains that once you open yourself to the demands of the outside world, it is very difficult to bring your full attention and focus to the most important task you need to complete each day. And the most important task you need to complete each day is prospecting. But Jeb, what if one of the emails is important? What should I do then? You know it's a bad idea to ignore the client. This is one of the most common whines I get from salespeople who are unwilling to face the truth about email. Of course some emails are going to be important, but important does not mean urgent. You will rarely get an urgent email first thing in the morning, and if you do, as Anthony Iorino says, they will call or text you on your mobile phone, not just send an email. Take care of your prospecting block first, and then manage email. Leverage the platinum hours. During the golden hours, time is money, literally. To maximize sales productivity and your income, your total focus must be on prospecting and customer engagement activities. That, of course, means there will be a number of tasks that will have to wait until before or after the golden hours. We call these periods the platinum hours. Top-earning sales pros set aside time each morning or late each afternoon to attack important non-selling activities before the demands of the sales day kick in or after they've been addressed. They use the platinum hours for building prospecting lists, research, pre-call planning, developing proposals and presentations, creating contracts and getting approval, social selling activities, email prospecting, prospect research and call objective planning, planning an organization, administration and reports, responding to email, calendar management, and CRM management. The objective of the platinum hours is to set up your sales day so that all of your focus can be spent on high-value selling activities. Measure your worth. When I was in my 20s, I worked for an entrepreneur. The man was worth millions and ran several successful companies. He was also a hands-on leader who, for some reason, took an interest in me. Because of this, I had the chance to spend time with him whenever he traveled in to visit my location. One day over lunch, he asked me what I did on the 2 days I'd taken off the week before. I was blown away that he would even know that. He had several thousand people working in his company, but that was Phil. He knew everything. I explained that I'd done some home repairs. I proudly told him, and I was proud of my accomplishment, how I had learned new plumbing and electric skills and made the repairs on my own. He leaned forward and asked, "How many hours did it take you to do that work, including going back and forth to the hardware store to get and exchange parts?" I replied that it had taken up most of the 2 days. "But it didn't beat me," I exclaimed. "I got the job done." "So about how many hours do you think it actually took you?" he asked. I thought about it and said, "I guess about 12 in all." "Let me ask you a question," he said. "How long do you think it would have taken a skilled plumber or electrician to do the same work?" "I don't know, probably a couple of hours. It was pretty simple stuff. I'm just not good at things like that, so it took me longer." "Nothing's ever easy," I said sarcastically. "Well, why didn't you just hire a specialist to do the work?" Well, plumbers are expensive, I said. Why pay them when I can do it myself? How expensive? Well, the ones I called quoted $150 for the repair. That's way too much for something that simple. Then he pulled out a pen and paper and said, all right, why don't we do some math? You're one of our top people. How much do you think you'll earn this year with your base and commission? I thought about it for a moment, doing the math in my head, and said, probably around $75,000. Well, how many weeks a year do you actually work at selling? 52, I shot back. Not so fast, he shook his head. You've got some vacation time, meetings, holidays, and you might even be out sick. So you're not going to be selling every week, are you? Well, not exactly. Okay, so how many weeks will you actually be working? Well, when you look at it that way, I guess maybe 48. Yep, he replied, that sounds about right. And how many hours a day are you actually available for sales activities? With a little bit of trepidation, I answered, I guess 6 or 7. Well, that's true when you take out lunch and breaks. So let's do the math. 6 hours a day times 5 days is 30 hours of selling time. And $75,000 divided by the 48 weeks you're actually working is $1,563. Divide that by 30 hours, and that is $52 an hour. He let that sink in for a moment before going on. So, Jeb, you're worth $52 an hour when you're working. The repairs you did on your days off took 12 hours. You did them yourself because you felt paying $150 was too expensive. But based on your math, it cost you $624 to do them yourself. Don't you think your time would have been more wisely spent at the office selling rather than at home pretending to be a plumber? Can you see now why paying a specialist $150 was actually a bargain? I had no response to that because I'd never looked at things that way. Phil went on to explain that most people don't take the time to calculate their worth, and because they don't understand what they are worth, they spend their time on activities that are far below their pay grade, and this holds them back. It was one of the most poignant lessons I've ever learned, and one I've never forgotten. You must know your worth. When you know your worth, you become acutely aware of the damage that doing, say, $10 an hour work like data entry during $50 an hour prime selling time has on your income. The law of triviality describes the human tendency to waste time on unimportant activities while mission-critical tasks are ignored. It's why so many salespeople allow non-selling activities to become an excuse for their failure to focus on selling activities. It's not uncommon for salespeople to waste 50% or more of their time on low-value tasks. Understanding what you are worth helps you gain awareness of the cost of focusing on trivial things. Getting a bead on your worth is easy to do. Just take your annual income goal and divide it by the number of golden hours in each year, and you'll find out what you're worth per hour. Use this per hour number as a gauge to determine whether a given task, activity, or assignment is moving you towards your income goals or away from them. When you take time to gain a clear understanding of what each golden hour is worth, you will make far better decisions about how to spend your time. Effective time management is about the choices you make. The bottom line is you've got roughly 8 golden hours each day to sell and make a living, and you have a choice. You can either dawdle those hours away doing things that don't make you money, whining that you have too much paperwork, there's too much reporting, there's admin, traffic, bad prospects, or whatever lame excuse you are using that day to justify the fact that you are wasting your time. Or you can plan effectively, block your time, and stick to your guns when others try to corrupt, interrupt, and usurp your time for their use. Chapter 9, The Four Objectives of Prospecting. I don't focus on what I'm up against. I focus on my goals, and I try to ignore the rest. Venus Williams. If you don't know where you're going, you might end up someplace else. That's one of my favorite quotes from the late, great Yogi Berra. Sadly, this is also how many salespeople approach prospecting, on a wing and a prayer. From the get-go, I've been clear that my objective is to teach you how to be both efficient and effective with prospecting. Another way to say this is balancing quantity with quality. Knowing your objective for each call makes you more efficient because you're able to build prospecting blocks and group your prospecting channel touches around those objectives. This allows you to move faster and make more prospecting touches in less time. Developing a defined objective makes you effective because on each prospecting call, email, social media touch, networking event, or referral request, you know exactly what to ask for and how to bridge to your prospect's problem to give them a compelling reason to accept your request. The objective is the primary outcome you expect from your prospecting touch. And there are four core prospecting objectives: set an appointment, gather information and qualify, close a sale, and build familiarity. Of course, your situation, industry, prospect base, product, and service are unique, as will be your prospecting objectives. So here are some quick rules of thumb to get you started when developing your prospecting objectives. If you are selling a complex, high-risk, high-cost product or service, your primary objective will most often be an appointment with a qualified decision-maker, influencer, or other stakeholder who can help you move the deal forward. Your secondary objective will be to gather information, and your tertiary objective will be to build familiarity. If you are selling a transactional, low-risk, low-cost product or service, and you are in inside sales, your primary objective will be closing the sale and secondarily gathering qualifying information. If you are selling a transactional, low-risk, low-cost product and you are in outside sales and prospecting via any channel other than in person, phone, email, text, or social, your primary objective will be to set an appointment and secondarily to gather information. If you are prospecting in person, knocking on the prospect's door, your primary objective will be to close the deal. If you have a highly qualified database of prospects in your CRM, the primary objective of most of your prospecting calls will be setting appointments with prospects as their buying window opens. The secondary objective will be building familiarity to increase the probability that your prospect will engage when that buying window opens. If the product or service you are selling can only be purchased during specific buying windows, for example, when a contract expires or within a defined budgetary period, then gathering information to qualify the buying window will be your primary objective and building familiarity your secondary objective. You don't want to waste time setting an appointment with a prospect that cannot buy because of contractual or budgetary handcuffs. Once you have identified the buying window, your primary objective will shift to setting an appointment. And if you are new in your territory or working for a startup or a new division, your primary objective will be gathering information to build your database and identifying decision makers and qualify buying windows and budgets. The secondary objective will be to build familiarity. Lots of salespeople stumble from unqualified prospect to unqualified prospect and wonder why at the end of the day, week, or month they sold nothing. This is why it's so important to have an objective for every prospecting touch. Prospecting is a contact sport. Prospecting, in many ways, is a brutal contact sport that shuns the nuance, art, and finesse of moving a deal through the sales pipe. To be effective, you've got to know what you want and ask for it. To be efficient, you've got to get in as many prospecting touches as possible during each prospecting block. Prospecting is not for building relationships, selling, or chatting up your buyer. It is for setting appointments, qualifying, building familiarity, and when it makes sense, moving into the sales process right on the spot. You don't need brilliant scripts, you don't need complex strategies, and you don't need to overcomplicate it. You have no time to waste on small talk, chit-chat, or long-winded scripts or long-winded emails written by some dude in marketing who has never been within 50 feet of a prospect. You've got to get to the point, ask for what you want, and move on to the next touch. Set an appointment. The most valuable activity in the sales process is a set appointment, no matter where you are in the pipe. Initial meeting, discovery meetings, presentations, closing meetings, and so on. And to be absolutely clear, an appointment is a meeting that is on your calendar and your prospect's calendar. In other words, they are expecting you to show up face-to-face in person or by phone, video call, or web conference at a specific time and date. Many salespeople confuse just stop by, I'll be here anytime, and call me maybe statements from their prospects to be a commitment for an appointment. So let's not mince words. Call me maybe and just stop by anytime are not appointments. And to believe that they are and to put them on your calendar as such is pure delusion. And as we've already learned, in sales, you cannot be delusional and successful at the same time. It's only an appointment when you have a firm commitment for a specific meeting time. Consider how much time is wasted driving to or calling into prospects who are not there because they never had a commitment to be there in the first place. Consider the emotional cost of believing that you have a firm commitment only to discover that you don't. Working with prospects who are not committed to moving to the next step, either an initial meeting or a subsequent meeting, is like pushing a rope. You expend a tremendous amount of energy and emotion trying to move the deal forward, but you never get anywhere. Recently, I was working with an outbound inside sales rep who sells capital equipment to mid-market buyers in the manufacturing space. I followed up with him a few weeks after he and his peers attended a training program that we had designed for his company. Here's our dialogue. Armando, tell me how things are going. Armando sighs and says, I guess okay. So I asked, how do you mean? He says, well, this appointment thing is not working out for me. How come? Well, I can't get anyone to show up. Well, what percentage of your appointments are no-shows? I don't know. I guess around 80% of them. Okay, well, tell me about the last one that was a no-show. Armando thinks for a second and says, well, I had a meeting scheduled with Jessica Thompson, a buyer at Amcorp International. She's never purchased anything from us before, and we had an appointment scheduled to review our line. When I called this morning at 10 a.m., she didn't answer the phone. I tried several more times until I got her assistant, who said she was out traveling. Okay, well, Armando, did she accept the meeting request you sent? Well, I didn't send one. How come? Well, when I called her last week, she said she was super busy and would be happy to meet with me another time. She said she was usually available in the mornings and I could call anytime I wanted. I suggested 10 a.m. today and she said that would be fine to just call her anytime. Well, Armando, was that a real commitment to 10 a.m. on her part or more of a brush off just to get you off the phone? Well, I guess when you look at it that way, it was a brush off. Armando and I went through all the appointments he had on his calendar for the next 7 days. And not surprisingly, almost all of them were call-me-maybe non-committal wishes that he had accepted as real. Delusion gets you nowhere. So here's a simple rule. It is only an appointment when it is on your calendar and your prospect's calendar, and your prospect is expecting you to show up at a specific time, date, and place, either physical or virtual. Gather information and qualify. I'm a big fan of Little League Baseball. It's a rite of passage that helps kids build character, hone their values, and learn how to win and lose. Several years back, when my son played Little League, we were fortunate to be on a team with great coaches who invested their time to help our sons learn to love the game. And along the way, they helped our tight-knit group of parents learn a few lessons too. In one of our most intense games, we were in the bottom of the sixth inning with two outs and the bases loaded. The game was tied. With the winning run on third base, all we needed was a hit to win the game and advance to the playoffs. As our next batter walked from the dugout towards the batter's box, Coach Sandro pulled him aside for one last pep talk. He kneeled in front of the 10-year-old young man, got a handful of his jersey near the collar, and gave him some sage advice. Whatever you do, Coach Sandro admonished, don't swing at nothing ugly. As Coach Sandro walked back to his position on the third base line, it struck me how profound his coaching was when applied to sales and, frankly, life. If you've ever played baseball or softball or watched your kids play, you've no doubt witnessed a player chasing a wild pitch, too high, too low, or way outside the strike zone. The awkward swing of the bat, swishing through thin air, leaves the player off balance and embarrassed. It is sometimes funny to watch, but mostly the fans, coaches, and players just echo a collective groan and wonder why in the world the player took a swing at that pitch. Well, it's no different in sales. Each day, salespeople waste time, energy, and emotion swinging at ugly deals. Deals that are unprofitable, unqualified, not in the buying window, don't have a budget, don't have an identified decision maker, or because of contracts, don't have the ability to buy. From the outside looking in, it's obvious that these low-probability, ugly deals will never close and will divert the salesperson's time and attention from better opportunities. Yet in spite of the obvious signs, salespeople forge forward either delusional or oblivious, placing these deals in their pipelines and projections and wasting endless hours working on ugly deals that will never close. And sadly, the results are predictable. Almost all of these salespeople strike out. Savvy sales professionals are super disciplined in qualifying prospects. They understand that time is money, and it is a waste of time to work with prospects that are not going to buy. They know that qualified buyers are scarce, and a moment spent with a prospect who will never buy takes them away from their most important task, finding prospects that will buy. It begins with gathering information during prospecting. While setting an appointment is your primary objective with prospects you have already pre-qualified as potential buyers, gathering information is your primary objective with prospects you have not yet qualified. Here's what I mean. If we were to draw a bell curve based on the statistical distribution of qualified prospects in your database or potential customers in your marketplace, a small percentage will be totally qualified and in the buying window. A larger percentage will be totally qualified, but they won't be in the buying window due to budget restrictions or contractual obligations. A larger percentage will be semi-qualified, meaning you will have some information, but there will be holes in your data. An even larger percentage will be potential buyers, but you will have almost no information about them or the information will be outdated. And a small percentage will never be buyers or will be out of business or the record in the database will be bogus. Your drive as a sales professional should always be to spend your time with the most qualified prospects in your database. This means you will want to set appointments with the prospects that are highly qualified and in the buying window. Nurture the prospects that you've qualified but are not in the buying window. Gather information on the prospects for which you have some or no data so you can qualify their potential and learn their buying windows, and eliminate the prospect records that are bogus, out of business, too small, too big, or will never be buyers. Now, there are some sales experts who will tell you to set an appointment with every prospect and qualify later. Many are adamant about it, and I get their point. They've observed so many salespeople using qualifying as a reason to avoid making calls that they figure the best way to get them to prospect is to have them set appointments and do the qualifying once they're in the meeting. And it probably does make sense to just set the appointment if you sell a product or service that is non-contractual, if there is a high probability that most of your prospects will be buyers because your product is something they use all the time, if there is no set budgetary period for making these purchases, or if the decision-maker role is fairly consistent and usually a single person. However, when your product or service is complex, contractual, especially when the contract requires exclusivity with a single vendor or limited number of vendors, the sales cycle is long, decision-making is done at a high level in the organization, there is a defined budgetary period or budgets need to be approved in advance, your best bet is to qualify first and then set the appointment. Define the strike zone. The first step in qualifying is to clearly define the strike zone. Far too many sales professionals, sales organizations, and companies, especially startups and small businesses, fail to develop a profile of a qualified prospect. This includes the optimal time for engaging the prospect prior to the opening of the buying window. Here's a blinding flash of the obvious. If you don't define the strike zone, you will waste a lot of time chasing ugly deals. This process, by the way, shouldn't be difficult. If you work for a big company, just go sit down with your sales manager and some of the more successful reps. They'll likely have the information you'll need, like decision maker roles, account size, buying windows, budgetary windows, and contractual obligations to build a profile of your ideal opportunity. If you work for a small company or startup, start by analyzing your product and service delivery strengths and weaknesses. Look for patterns and commonalities among your best customers. Analyze the deals you are closing and gain a deeper understanding of trigger events that open buying windows. And based on this information, decide how soon you need to engage your prospect prior to the buying window opening. You'll also need to uncover common buying roles and then finally develop the profile of the prospect that is most likely to do business with you and over the long term be a profitable, happy customer. Once you have developed the profile of your ideal customer, you can develop the questions you'll need to ask to qualify your prospects and identify the best opportunities. Next, make a commitment to measure every prospect, deal, and customer against this profile. When they don't fit, develop the discipline to walk away. Now, let's be clear. I am not saying that every deal must fit your profile perfectly in order to enter your sales pipe. This is not how things work in the real world. In some cases, it makes sense to take some risk and swing outside the strike zone. However, there is a difference between taking a calculated, data-driven risk and chasing an ugly deal. The end goal is keeping your pipeline full of viable, qualified deals that have a high probability of closing. This is why fanatical prospectors use daily prospecting activity to systematically qualify their databases. Heed Coach Sandro's advice. Don't swing at nothing ugly. Close the sale. When you are selling transactional, low-risk, or relatively low-cost products or services and prospecting via telephone and in-person, your primary prospecting objective is closing the sale right on the spot. If you are prospecting via email, text, or social channels, your primary objective is to convert that prospecting touch into a sales conversation that leads to closing the sale. When closing the sale is your objective, the prospecting interaction gets a bit more complicated because you've got to engage, qualify, and ask them to commit to giving up their time for a sales conversation right on the spot. On the phone or in person, where you have the highest probability of a one-call close, this means you have to quickly get past the initial reflex response or brush-off, ask one or two questions to qualify the opportunity, and gain an agreement for an appointment right on the spot that gives you the space to ask deeper questions, bridge to a solution, and close the sale. It all happens in the span of a few minutes, and it requires poise, confidence, and a fundamental mastery of the sales process. The techniques for closing a sale on a prospecting call are beyond the scope of this audiobook. However, we'll discuss the techniques that you'll need to get past the initial pushback and objections and move your prospect directly into a sales conversation in chapter 15, 16, and 18. Build familiarity. Our data and data that we've gathered and analyzed from a diverse set of sources indicate that it takes on average 1 to 3 touches to re-engage in an active customer. 1 to 5 touches to engage a prospect who is in the buying window and is familiar with you and your brand. 3 to 10 touches to engage a prospect who has a high degree of familiarity with you and your brand but is not in the buying window. 5 to 12 touches to engage a warm inbound lead. 5 to 20 touches to engage a prospect who has some familiarity with you and your brand, buying window dependent, and 20 to 50 touches to engage a cold prospect who does not know you or your brand. These are general averages. Depending on your overall brand recognition, geographic location, prospecting channel, product, service, sales cycle, and industry vertical, you may find that these numbers shift in or out of your favor. The point, however, is not the numbers. It's the story these numbers tell us. Familiarity plays an important role in getting prospects to engage. The more familiar a prospect is with you, your brand, or your company, the more likely they will be willing to accept and return your calls, reply to your emails, accept a social media connection request, respond to a text message, and engage when you are prospecting in person. We're going to do a much deeper dive into the law of familiarity in Chapter 12. Building familiarity is almost always a secondary or tertiary objective of a prospecting touch, though at times, especially with strategic prospecting campaigns, it may be your primary objective. Familiarity as a prospecting objective requires a long-term focus because it is improved through the cumulative impact of ongoing prospecting activity. This is why savvy sales professionals create strategic prospecting campaigns, or SPCs, that cross-leverage prospecting channels to systematically build familiarity. For example, let's say you've done some research and uncovered the contact names of 100 manufacturing operations managers. Problem is, they don't know you and you don't know them, and many of them may have no familiarity with your company. In this scenario, it may take multiple touches over a long period of time to get one of these potential buyers to engage. To gain their attention, you might develop an SPC that includes phone calls and voicemails, email, social, targeted trade shows, and industry conferences. Your primary objective is to create enough familiarity that these cold prospects are more likely to engage. Each time you leave a voicemail, they hear your name, your company name, and their familiarity with you increases. Each time you send an email, they read your name and see your email address, company name, and service brand, and their familiarity with you increases. When you connect with them on LinkedIn, familiarity increases. When you like, comment on, or share something they post on social media, familiarity increases. And when you meet them at an industry conference and put a face with a name, familiarity increases. The bottom line is, if you don't have a plan and you don't know your objectives, your prospecting blocks will be far less effective and you will waste time. However, when you build more effective prospecting lists with clear objectives centered on specific prospecting channels, your prospecting blocks are easier, faster, more impactful, and generate far better results. Chapter 10, Leveraging the Prospecting Pyramid. The only difference between a mob and a trained army is organization. Calvin Coolidge. When you get into the office in the morning and begin your prospecting block, which prospects do you choose to call or touch first? Last year, I was hired by a company to develop a prospecting training program for their sales organization. The sales team was missing its number, and the CEO was looking to my firm to help him reverse this trend. My first step was to sit and watch the sales team make their morning prospecting calls. The team worked in a comfortable modern office environment and had a top-tier CRM that was packed full of pre-vetted prospects and contact records. They also had access to robust social media and business intelligence tools that offered deep insight into their prospective customers. And these tools were integrated into the CRM. The director of sales expected his sales team to be on the phones qualifying and setting appointments starting at 8 a.m. I introduced myself to the team and then took a seat in the corner and observed. In particular, I kept my eye on the sales rep in the cubicle close to me. After an hour of watching this rep, I asked him a simple question. When you pick up the phone each morning, how do you know which prospect to call first? He looked confused by my question, and I could see the wheels turning as he searched for the right answer. Finally, he replied, "I don't know. I just log into the CRM and start calling." It was crystal clear from the team's sales results that collectively they shared the same philosophy. There was no rhyme or reason to their prospecting pattern. They just showed up in the morning, opened up their CRM, ran a rudimentary filter to pull leads for a specific geographic location, and called the first prospect that popped up. They were wasting a huge amount of time randomly dialing through their database. No plan, no objective, no qualifying methodology. The result was a miserable prospecting experience, a weak pipeline, and desperation appointments and demos set with poorly qualified prospects just to get any kind of win. Following the phone block, I gathered the team together and drew a triangle or a pyramid on the whiteboard in the training room. I asked the question again to the entire group. When you pick up the phone in the morning, how do you decide which prospect to call first? Again, blank stares until one of the young reps said, I usually pick a city or zip code in my territory, create a list, and start calling the first prospect on that list. I followed up with, is it possible to sort that list in a more meaningful way? Once again, crickets. Okay, let me ask this a different way. Ideally, if you could call any list of prospects, which ones would you want on your list? They were thinking a little harder now, and finally someone blurted out, the ones most likely to buy. Bingo! That's exactly right. So, how might you identify the prospects that have the highest probability of buying? Someone blurted out, prospects who have a budget. Now they were thinking, someone else, prospects who have expiring contracts with the competitors. From the back of the room, prospects who were referrals. Large prospects, prospects with more than 50 employees. Then more, prospects who called us or filled out one of our web forms. Prospects who came to our booth at the last trade show. Prospects who are fully qualified, but we've been unable to set an appointment with them. They were finally getting it. Walk like an Egyptian, managing the prospecting pyramid. Salespeople who struggle with prospecting often view their prospect database as a square. In other words, they treat every prospect exactly the same. For this reason, they attack their database randomly, with no system and no objective. There are several problems with this approach. First, it is statistically inefficient. When your first call and subsequent calls are made merely by chance, you might call a prospect who is ready to take action, or you might not. However, because only a small number of your prospects will be in the buying window at any given time, the statistical probability that you will call poorly qualified prospects is high. The result is ineffective prospecting blocks that make you feel like you're getting nowhere, far more rejection, and low productivity. Your sales results, income, confidence, and self-esteem will all suffer. Top performers have no interest in hunting and pecking for opportunities, so they design their lists to make prospecting blocks efficient and effective. They segment their prospects by potential or size of the opportunity and the probability that the prospect will convert into a sale. They organize their prospecting block to get themselves in position to win with highly qualified prospects who are in the buying window. Top performers view their prospecting database as a pyramid. At the bottom of the pyramid are the thousands of prospects they know little about other than a company name and perhaps some contact information. They don't even know if the information about the prospect is correct, and there's probably a pretty good chance that it isn't. The action that they take with these prospects is to move them up the pyramid by gathering information to correct and confirm data, fill in the missing pieces, and begin the qualifying process. Higher up on the pyramid, the information improves. There is solid contact information, including email addresses. There may be information on competitors, product or service buying frequency, the size of the budget, and other demographic information. There may also be contact information for decision makers and influencers. With these prospects, the goal is to identify the buying window and all of the potential stakeholders. Moving higher up, potential buying windows have been identified. There are complete contact records for decision makers and influencers, including social profiles. The focus at this level is to implement nurturing campaigns to stay in front of confirmed decision makers in anticipation of identified future buying windows. Further up still are conquest prospects. This is a highly targeted list of the best or largest opportunities in your territory, and there will be a limited number of conquest prospects, between 10 and 100. The focus for conquest prospects includes nurturing and regular touches, stakeholder identification, buying window qualification, monitoring for trigger events, and building familiarity. Closer to the top are hot inbound leads and referrals. These prospects require immediate follow-up to qualify and/or move them into the pipeline. And at the tip-top are highly qualified prospects who are moving into the buying window due to an immediate need, contract expiration, trigger event, or budgetary period. These are your highest priority prospects and should be on the top of your daily prospecting list. The goal is to move them into the sales pipe. The key to leveraging the prospecting pyramid philosophy is a systematic daily focus on gathering qualifying information that identifies buying windows and stakeholders and moves prospects up the pyramid based on that information. Powerful lists get powerful results. Being a more efficient and effective prospector begins and ends with an organized, targeted prospecting list. A high-quality prospecting list is like a track for your prospecting train. It eliminates wasted time hunting and pecking for qualified prospects and helps you focus on a specific objective within a particular prospecting channel. The sad fact, though, is most salespeople are working off poorly constructed lists or, in many cases, no list at all. Some companies try to provide lists for their reps, but most don't, and the ones that do usually do it poorly. Building effective and robust prospecting lists requires consistent effort and discipline, which is why most salespeople don't do it. It's so much easier to just open up the CRM and start calling the first prospect record you find. This is a wake-up call. The quality of the list you work from during each prospecting block has a more significant impact on the success of the block than any other element except your mindset. When you build powerful lists, you get powerful results. Prospecting lists should be constructed based on the following filters or other methodologies, depending on your unique situation. Use these filters in combination to structure your prospecting list for maximum impact. First, prospecting objective, whether it's to set an appointment, gather information, close a sale, or build familiarity. Next, your prospecting channel, phone, email, social, text, in-person, or networking. Next, your qualification level, the highest qualified at the top of the list, the least qualified at the bottom of the list. Next would be potential, the largest opportunities at the top of the list with the lowest potential at the bottom of the list. Probability, the highest probability to achieve your objective at the top of the list and the lowest probability to achieve your objective at the bottom of the list. And territory plan, the day of the week, the postal code, the street, the geographic grid, or the city. You also want to organize your list by inbound leads, conquest prospects, decision makers in stakeholder roles, industry or market vertical, customers that purchase a specific type of product or service, seasonal customers, inactive customers, and leads from recent trade shows or conferences. Some of these filters can be automated in your CRM, while others may require some manual decisions. The key is to automate the process as much as possible with preset filters, views, and reports to make it easy to pull lists based on your prospecting objectives. There will only be a handful of prospects in your database at any given time that are in the buying window, and you've got to get in front of them before they buy or the window of dissatisfaction from a trigger event dissipates. Start each morning with a prospecting block focused on a list of these top-of-pyramid prospects while you are fresh, feeling your best, and motivated. Because these prospects are in the buying window, it will be much easier to convert them into an appointment, demo, or sale. Starting your day by calling the prospects on the top of your pyramid will deliver early wins. These wins give you confidence and motivation to attack the remainder of the sales day. Once you've exhausted your high-potential prospects, focus your prospecting activity on qualifying and nurturing activities with conquest accounts. Follow that by focusing on qualifying the hundreds or thousands of prospects lower on the pyramid. If each day you start at the top of the pyramid and set quality appointments early, you will have time left over to systematically qualify the other prospects in your database, moving them to the top of your pyramid. Over time, you'll experience more successful prospecting blocks, a dynamic prospect database, and a full pipeline. Tomorrow morning, when you get ready to make your prospecting calls, take a look at the first name on your list and ask yourself, is this the best prospect to call? Then get familiar with the filters and sort tools on your CRM program and build your own prospecting pyramid. Chapter 11. Own your database. Why the CRM is your most important sales tool. The most expensive thing you can do in sales is spend your time with the wrong prospect. Jeb Blunt. I hate writing or talking about CRMs. It's boring and tiresome. It's also a turnoff because I know salespeople have no love for the CRM. Honestly, it pained me to include this important but tedious subject in this audiobook. But this is the brutal and often ignored reality. There is no weapon or tool in your sales arsenal that is more important or impactful to your long-term income stream than your prospect database. Nothing. Your database of prospects is what helps you make a living now and in the future. It does not make a difference what you sell. A well-managed, living, breathing prospect database is a golden goose that keeps on giving. Your CRM is the most important tool in your sales arsenal because it allows you to manage the details and tasks related to many different contacts without having to remember everything. It keeps you organized, manages your pipeline, and saves your deals and relationships from getting derailed. It makes life easier by doing work for you. It allows you to segment and sort your prospect database and build prospecting lists based on any field or group of fields in the database. This makes you exponentially more effective and efficient in your prospecting activities. And it helps you systematically qualify prospects so that you move them up the prospecting pyramid. When you peel all the technology away, a CRM is just a software-based filing system that makes it easier for you to manage and access information because it does a very simple task. It remembers important things for you and reminds you when those things are important. Face it, you are moving fast and you forget things. And in sales, the little things are big things. And a well-managed CRM will prevent slip-ups that could cost you deals. Own it like a CEO. Here's the brutal truth about the CRM. If you don't own it, you will never reach your true earning potential. Owning it means applying the CEO mindset we discussed earlier. It means being accountable for maintaining the integrity of your prospect database, not waiting until your manager is screaming at you because you haven't updated a record in a month. Taking time to make copious notes following sales calls and logging those calls. Putting new leads in the system rather than carting around a pocket full of business cards you've collected from prospects. And rather than sitting around whining about how you don't understand the CRM, taking the time to learn it through trial and error and online learning tools. Fanatical prospectors own their database. They own it because they get it. Their database is where targeted lists come from. Their database is what makes them more efficient and effective. Your CRM should be so important to you that you eat, sleep, and drink it. I had a rep who worked for my company for 9 months. This guy was talented and he could sell, but he could never keep his pipeline full and never even got close to his quota. When we finally started to dig into what was going on, we discovered he had only logged into the CRM once the entire time he worked for us. It was sad but true, but by then it was too late, and we were forced to fire him. Some salespeople don't see how the system benefits them personally. They've got a sales manager on their case about updating the CRM, but in their mind, they're doing it for the company, not themselves. It's a simple mindset issue. These salespeople see themselves as working for the man, whereas fanatical prospectors believe they are the CEO of their own territory. They are working for themselves. Now, I can get on my soapbox and preach. I can warn you of all the consequences. I can explain the benefits. But the only person who can motivate you to fully exploit your CRM and invest diligently in building a quality prospect database is you. If you choose not to invest in your database, as the saying goes, you can't fix stupid. A trash can or a gold mine? More often than not, salespeople treat their database like a trash can rather than a gold mine. Call notes are not inputted, records aren't kept up to date, and calls are not logged. This inattention to detail causes the value and integrity of the database to be undermined, leaving salespeople struggling to set appointments and engage the right prospects at the right time with the right message because they don't know who to call. Gathering information and qualifying is where managing and building your database really pays off. Over time, through relentless prospecting and research, You gain a clear picture that helps you fully qualify the opportunity. You know the key decision makers and influencers, what your prospects buy and how much, who your competitors are, potential trigger events, and most importantly, when the buying window opens. Building a database is like filling in a jigsaw puzzle. It takes time, lots of work, and sometimes there is not much evidence that it is paying off. The key is recognizing the cumulative value of small wins. I'll often hear a sales rep bemoaning a call that he felt didn't go well, rather than celebrating the small nugget of information that added another piece to the qualification puzzle. When it comes to building a powerful prospect database, my philosophy is simple. Put every detail about every account and every interaction with every contact in your CRM. Make good, clear notes. Never procrastinate. Do not take shortcuts. Develop the discipline to do it right the first time, and your CRM will pay off for you over time. Chapter 12. The Law of Familiarity. After seeing a lot of the world, I now tend to return to the same spots. I enjoy the familiarity. Louise Nerding. The more familiar a prospect is with you, your brand, and or your company, the more likely they'll be to accept and return your calls, open your emails, accept a social media connection request, respond to a text message, accept an invite to an event or webinar, download information from a link you sent them, engage in sales conversations, and ultimately do business with you. That's the law of familiarity. This is supported by data that indicates that it can take between 20 and 50 touches to engage a prospect with little to no familiarity with you or your company, but just 1 to 10 touches to engage an inactive customer, a warm inbound lead, or prospect who has a high degree of familiarity with you, your company, or your brand. The lack of familiarity is why you get so many objections to your request for prospects' time. When prospects don't know you, it's much harder to get in the door. Prospecting lubrication. This is why it's in your best interest to invest time and effort to build familiarity with your prospects. Familiarity lubricates prospecting because it makes the prospect's decision to give you their time feel less risky. There even comes a point when a prospect will readily communicate and build a first-name relationship with you, even when they aren't interested in buying at the moment. Sean Burke, CEO of KiteDesk, calls this the familiarity threshold. When you earn enough trust to cross the familiarity threshold, you also gain the ability to communicate more freely, including through social media inboxes and text messaging, without being considered intrusive. You won't cross the familiarity threshold with most of your prospects because you'll never have enough time to make that level of investment with all of them. Crossing the familiarity threshold requires a significant investment of time, intellect, emotion, energy, and technology. This is why you must create your conquest prospect list and develop strategic prospecting plans so you focus your time and attention on building familiarity with your most valuable prospects. The 5 levers of familiarity. The familiarity threshold explains why the senior reps in your organization, the ones who've been in the same territories for years, make it look so easy. The years of investment they've made in building familiarity in their territory have paid off. If you were to take a closer look at their efforts, you'd discover that there were 5 levers that helped them build familiarity over time. Persistent and consistent prospecting. The first step in creating familiarity is through persistent and consistent daily prospecting. Each time you call, email, meet face-to-face, drop off a business card, and leave a voicemail, you create familiarity. This is one of the core reasons persistence pays off. The more times a prospect sees or hears your name, the more familiar you become to them and the gatekeepers that protect them. Simply put, the more you prospect, the more familiar you become to your prospects. Referrals and introductions. Ron, you mentioned that you still have close ties to your former company. Do you know who makes the decision on sales training over there? I was speaking with the decision maker at one of my top clients. Yep, That's Mary Walker. She used to work for me. Great lady. You'll like her. Ron looked down at his phone. Let me get you her number. A few seconds went by, and he gave me her contact information. Then I asked, Ron, would you mind giving her a call and making an introduction? He looked up from his phone and said, sure, no problem. Then he dialed, got Mary on the line, and said, I'm standing here with a guy named Jeb Blunt. He's been helping us with developing our sales training curriculum, and you two need to meet. He's going to be giving you a call. The most powerful and direct path to familiarity is a referral or introduction. The referral gives you instant credibility because you get to ride on the coattails of a person who is already trusted by your prospect. Now, there are three basic types of referrals. First, there are customer referrals. These come from happy clients that trust you. The key to generating these referrals is developing a disciplined, systematic process for asking for referrals. The next are personal referrals, and these come from friends, family, and acquaintances. These are people who know you and are willing to send prospects your way. So you need to take time to educate your personal connections on what you do and your ideal prospects so they know what to look for. Then, and this is critical, keep reminding them so they don't forget about you. Finally, there are professional referrals. And these come from relationships you've developed with other professionals in related industries or with salespeople who may call on the same type of prospects but don't compete with you. These are typically mutually beneficial relationships. To generate these referrals, you must seek out, form, and make an ongoing investment in your professional relationships. The wider your professional network, the more referrals you'll generate. I've read dozens of books on referrals. These books offer excellent advice, techniques, and tips for generating referrals. For the sake of time, I'll give you a short synopsis of the core message that is common to every one of these books. The real secret to generating referrals is, number one, give a legendary customer experience, and number two, ask. That's it. Straightforward and simple. Yet while standing in front of a group of B2B sales reps just last month, I asked, how many of you provide great service to your customers? Raise your hand. Every hand in the room went up. How many of you asked for at least one referral last week? No hands went up. How about in the last month? Again, no hands. How about in the last quarter? One hand went up. How about in the last year? Three hands out of 100 salespeople went up. Shocking? Well, not really. I ask this question to groups of salespeople regularly, and the response is always the same. I'm not going to waste your time discussing why salespeople don't ask because the answer is more than obvious. They either fear getting turned down or they just don't think about it. It's relatively easy, low-key, and low-risk to ask a happy client for a referral. It goes like this. Patricia, thank you again for your business. I'm glad to hear you're happy with us. I'm working hard to add more customers like you. Would you be able to introduce me to other people in your network who might want to use our product? Yes, there are more strategic and powerful ways to ask. Yes, there are ways to make it easier for your customers to help you with referrals. What's most important, though, is the discipline to ask. Networking. There are opportunities to network in your community or in your territory every week. The first place to check is with the Chamber of Commerce in your territory. Then, Google or Bing the calendars of other business and civic organizations in your area. Finally, ask your prospects and customers which events, conferences, and trade shows they attend. Then, go. I don't think I can make this any clearer. Go shake hands, go meet people, go learn about them. You'll get leads and referrals, and nothing builds familiarity better than face-to-face contact. We'll talk about social prospecting and social media in the next chapter, but networking is the real social selling. To be successful at networking, refrain from becoming a walking, talking marketing brochure and get it through your thick skull that nobody cares about you or what you have to say. They want to talk about themselves. You don't go to networking events to sell. You are not there to set appointments, get leads, or close business. You are there to create connections with other people. You get those other things after the connections are established, and there should be no quid pro quo attached to your conversations. You create connections when you ask questions, listen, and become genuinely interested in other people. Maya Angelou said, "People will forget what you said or did, but they will always remember how you made them feel." Take this to heart as you invest time in networking events. Following up after networking events is the key to anchoring your new relationships and familiarity. Use hand